Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Helgi Walker for petitioner Verizon. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for a rebuttal. The decision whether and how to regulate the operations of broadband providers is a decision for Congress to make. Whatever the wisdom of such regulation, it is not up to the FCC to decide those important and hotly debated questions entirely on its own. But that is what happened here. The agency's claim that Congress delegated authority for these rules on a purely implicit basis and in a conglomeration of over 20 different statutory provisions viewed as a whole is simply not credible for three basic reasons.
Don't you think it was the emanations from a penumbra?
Well, I'll let Mr. Lev speak to that. What the agency did say in paragraph 116 of the order was that it had no instructions in any one or even two or three provisions of the Act, but it was all 24, quote unquote, viewed as a whole that gave it this authority. But even then, it argues only some form of implied authority because it says elsewhere it has nothing specific. And, of course, it has long disclaimed any express authority in this area. I have three overarching reasons why their statutory authority theory must fail. And that is that, first, given the undisputed economic and political significance of the Internet, it's highly unlikely that Congress would have delegated authority for rules like this in such an opaque and, indeed, convoluted way.
Could I ask you to go back to your statutory argument?
Yes.
And focus particularly on 706, and in particular 706B.
706B?
Yeah.
Well, that suffers from the general problems I was about to describe. So if I may, I'll talk about those in the context of 706B.
You're going to talk about the language of
706B? 706B, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So it's just not credible that Congress would have authorized these kinds of rules in a provision that is about accelerating broadband deployment. That statute on its face is about the construction of broadband networks. It doesn't even purport to deal with the operations of networks once constructed, much less mandatory access rights for third parties on regulated terms.
That goes to your argument. It seems to me that that even if it has statutory authority, the commission's rationale for the order is unreasonable. Right?
No.
Isn't that your point?
No, Judge Tatel. We think they lack statutory authority under cases like Brown and Williamson, Gonzalez, MCI, this court's cases in.
But what about 706?
706B or A?
706B.
706B says that the agency may, when it makes a finding of inadequate deployment, which they had found consistently was perfectly adequate, but
it says, if the commission's determination is a negative, it shall take immediate action to accelerate deployment.
Yes.
By removing barriers, structure and investment, and by promoting competition in the telecommunications market.
Right. That on its face, Your Honor, does not even purport to deal with the subject at hand. The subject at hand is the regulation of the operation of networks once constructed.
Do you think that it clearly bars it? In other words, is it plain to you that that language itself prohibits it, or is it your position that you can't reasonably interpret that language?
It's our position that the agency's theory is barred under step one because, as this court has emphasized, in particular Judge Rogers in her opinions, ambiguity is a creature of context. You can't just look at those three or four words in isolation.
The context, though, here is that the commission for a long time had been acknowledged as having been delegated very broad authority in this area. And now, in 1996, Congress comes along with this section, what we're calling Section 706, and it has this very broad language to which Judge Tatel has alluded. And in that context, doesn't this court have to look at that language in terms of the plain language of a very broad authorization, given the background of which Congress is deemed to be aware in terms of what the Supreme Court has said about the authority of the commission?
Well, you look at that language, which again doesn't even purport to deal with the subject at hand. It definitely doesn't deal with third-party access rights at regulated rates.
It does deal with competition in the telecommunications market. by its literal terms, right?
It does, but it's also limited geographically.
You are part of the telecommunications market.
Well, these are actually information services.
I know, but you're still part of the telecommunications market.
We are.
Okay.
But there...
Now, let me ask this question. Suppose, hypothetically, I know the commission skirted this and didn't decide, but suppose, hypothetically, you are exercising market power in a particular market. Isn't that a barrier to broadband development?
No, it's not. What the statute says, well, actually 706B, the extent we're talking about 706B, says that the commission should take action to accelerate deployment, which is, again, the building of a network. But again,
if you were exercising market power, it would be difficult for anybody else to get into the market, therefore
The order actually disclaims that. The order actually says we're not doing that.
Hypothetically. Because the Justice Department and the FTC, both in their comments to the FCC, cautioned the FCC to limit their concern with market power.
I think in your
So let's ask the question.
Yes.
If the FCC had concluded, either generally or specifically with respect to certain markets, that one of the broadband providers, or two, exercised market power, doesn't that fit within the language of 706? That is to say, relieving that market power or regulating vis-a-vis that market power would accelerate broadband development.
706B still has geographical limits, though, Judge Silberman.
So if the FCC had limited its inquiry to those areas where there was market power, that would be consistent with the geographical limitations, wouldn't it?
I think looking only at that language, the agency might have a reasonable reading there, Your Honor, assuming a finding of market power and assuming that the rules were limited to areas where there was no broadband at all. But again, we have to look at the other indicia of
so
congressional intent.
Your answer to my hypothetical question is under those circumstances, the agency, the FCC, could legitimately interpret 706B to regulate the broadband provider in the fashion in which they try to do it here.
Well, we also have an argument that...
Do you answer the question now?
I think yes. I think that would...
That would be consistent with 706.
I think that is possible. With 706B.
Do you argue in your brief anywhere that the absence of a market power determination is relevant? I know you mentioned it in the First Amendment section of your brief, but you weren't making an argument about market power in your Chevron 2 or arbitrary and capricious analysis.
I think we made an argument that those kinds of considerations are really policy determinations.
No. You argued, the way I read your Chevron 2, and I mean, I don't know whether this is Chevron 2, reasonableness, or arbitrary and capricious. There's a big overlap. But your position, as I understood it from your brief, is that even if you get past the statutory language, this is either unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious, because A, the evidence doesn't support what the commission did, and B, its theory, namely that an open internet will lead to broadband investment, is unreasonable, right? Those are your arguments.
Yes, but we do have a step one argument, and I would like not to skip over that.
Judge Taylor is asking the question whether you at any point asserted the argument that I just articulated, and you did argue that there was not adequate evidence to support the proposition that there was a problem. And you now conceded that if there was evidence of market power in any particular locality, that would be evidence that would fall within 706B.
Yes, of course, the burden is on the commission to show that it has statutory authority. So whether we explicitly
establish the evidence.
Yes, and whether or not we pointed out that they didn't make a finding of market power is no negative for our side of the case.
But you did make it with respect to the First Amendment argument anyway.
Yes, we did. But if I could just go back.
Can I just ask you, though, you have referred to 706B as including a geographic requirement. How does that work in the context of the internet? In other words, when you look at the brief that was filed by AMICI by the internet engineers and technologists, that concept of geographic limitation, while it might make sense in the telephone context of putting up telephone poles or something like that. It wouldn't in the Internet context.
Well,
so that 706B, not referring specifically to a geographic limitation, shouldn't be read that way.
Actually, 706B says that Congress should make an inquiry to see if there's any areas of the country that don't have any broadband service at all, not even one broadband provider. And if they make a finding of inadequate deployment, they shall take immediate action to accelerate deployment.
Well, the Commission made that finding, didn't it?
Well, it said that, actually, for the first time in six reports, conveniently, just prior to this order, they decided that, actually, deployment was not adequate,
yes.
Even though 95% of Americans have broadband. We think that that unlocking of 706B was itself invalid because it was reverse engineered to create authority for these rules.
But you don't, I didn't read in your brief, I didn't see any challenge to the Commission's reasoning for the sixth deployment report.
Oh, we did, Your
Honor.
Namely
that, you said it was a post hoc effort to get around Comcast or something, but I mean, their reasoning was is that 200 kilobytes, which they had been using for years, wasn't no longer enough, right? I mean, it was not enough given streaming and everything to provide internet to all Americans, and so they increased the amount, and therefore the percentage of Americans with sufficiently rapid, fast broadband service dropped.
Well, still, there are vast areas of the country where there are multiple broadband providers. In fact, that represents most of the country. And for these rules to apply there, even on Judge Silberman's hypothetical, is, we think, barred by the statute. But, Your Honor, we can't just look at these six words in 706B. This Court has always looked to the rest of the Act, the structure of the Act, and so forth. Here we have other provisions in the Communications Act, 230B, that was passed at the same time as 706, that actually makes Congress's intent perfectly clear. It says the Internet shall remain unfettered by regulation.
But you've already conceded that if there were market power, that would not be a barrier, that language would not be a barrier to the FCC's regulation.
I think it would be easier or possible to reconcile that with the plain language of 230B, but these rules, Your Honor, cannot be reconciled with the plain language of 230B. We have other structural indications in the Act.
230B talks about maximizing user control.
230B says it is the policy of the United States that the Internet shall remain unfettered by regulation.
That's the last clause, but the policy before that talks about maximizing user.
Yeah,
control.
And that was the basis for the civil immunity that broadband providers got elsewhere in the statute. But there are other parts of the Act here that are directly relevant. Congress also created a distinct regulatory scheme as to telecom services on the one hand and information services on the other. These are information services that are to be not regulated pursuant to Title II. And finally, throughout the Communications Act, we see that Congress knows how to create access regimes with rate regulation. When it wants to do so, it knows how to do that very directly. Consider the Cable Must Carry statute, which is just like this, except it's in a different context. Consider Section 251, which required interconnection on what non-discriminatory terms. Consider even other statutes like the FERC statute, issue National Fuel, where Congress said the pipelines have to provide access to competitors and it has to be on non-discriminatory terms and even on price-regulated bases. There's nothing like that in 706 and 706B.
Let's come back to the common carrier argument in a minute. But I know I focused you on 706B, but what about 706A?
So I think the same problems relate to 706A, which is just not credible. And again, this is a step one argument. When you take all of the evidence into account here under Brown and Williamson, that this language is just not sufficiently clear to provide the basis. It's not rational that Congress would have stashed authority, massive authority, to regulate
like
entire
Chevron, that
industry.
That sounds like a Chevron 2 argument.
With all respect, Judge Tatel, it was a step one argument in Brown and Williamson and in Gonzales.
This language. I'm just not sure. I mean, I'm happy. What's clear about this? I mean, the argument about this language is it's either a policy statement or a grant of authority, correct? Those are the only two options.
706A.
Yeah, and B, both of them together.
We don't think it contains any standalone power, 706A. It merely...
You don't think it does.
We don't. It does not.
Mm-hmm.
It only...
It says the commission shall...
Shall what? Shall encourage.
Encourage.
And how shall it do that?
And through these three different techniques, including or other regulating methods that remove barriers to infrastructure investment. That's exactly what the commission says it's doing. Preventing the creation of barriers to infrastructure investment.
So first, Your Honor, I don't think other regulating methods can be read as a standalone grant of substantive regulatory power. That's a very important point and one that was debated in Comcast. The commission fails to take any account of the textual reference to state commissions. If 706A gives the FCC regulatory authority over and above or separate from that which is already contained elsewhere in the Act, then it has to do the same thing for state commissions.
But you got that problem, even if it's a policy statement, because it says shall.
Well, shall and encourage.
Congress can't direct state agencies to implement a policy.
And that's probably why it's, at the end of the day, hortatory, because it says shall encourage, not that they shall regulate. That reading's even more unlikely, Judge Tatel, when you step back and consider that by their own characterization, these rules are at least three steps removed from that actual statutory goal. These rules were not really adopted. I mean, this is bootstrapping.
Three steps removed?
Well, they say that the way they get to promoting broadband deployment is through this three-step chain of logic that they have. They had to try to find some way to link these rules to the statutory language in 706. So they said that an open internet will cause more people to want to use the internet, which will drive demand, which will in turn drive construction.
Right. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence. I really, it's a debated question, but there is a tremendous amount of evidence in the record that supports that.
Well, we disagree, and our amicus disagree,
but
the statutory authority point, Your Honor, that just makes it even less credible that they had to start so far removed from the actual purpose of the rules to try to squeeze this into the language of the statute. And on their reading of 706, Judge Tatel, even apart from the fact that they don't
take... I guess I'm not sure I understand why it's so... It's such a remote theory. One of the pieces of evidence, one of the briefs, I think it may be the engineer's brief, points out that, you know, what really spurred the development of broadband was the first development of a browser. The browser made it possible for millions of people to easily use the internet, and it drove, you know, investment in broadband, and they make the same point about streaming. I mean, I understand it's a debatable issue that there's evidence on both sides, but why is that so remote as to make what the commission did unreasonable?
Judge Tatel, the notion that these rules were really adopted in order to encourage broadband deployment by removing barriers to infrastructure is belied on the face of the rules themselves. Rule 8.1 says the purpose of these rules is to preserve the open internet, not to encourage broadband deployment, the construction of networks. It's just bootstrapping, Judge Tatel. And secondly, Brown and Williamson, if I could get back to that line of cases, requires a clear statement in cases like this. What Brown and Williamson said, and also Gonzalez and even MCI said, is that where there is a question of extraordinary importance, which all the parties here agree exists, statutory ambiguity is not enough to constitute an implied delegation of authority. The Supreme Court has required a clear statement. So even if you think this language is ambiguous, even if you think it's not crazy to fit these rules under 706A or 706B, there's still no clear statement here.
Counsel, let me take you back. We've got the basic argument, Brown and Williamson argument. What about the evidential question? I'm not sure I understand Judge Tatel's point here. I don't think there's any dispute on really evidence. The only evidence I see in the case is the number of markets that the FCC asserted were ones in which there was only one broadband provider or two. That's not a disputed issue of fact, is it?
No, but
okay.
We have...
What I understand is a dispute is a projection as to what might happen in the future. I don't think, if I understand, I don't see any evidence dispute between the two of you in terms of real evidence. Is there?
We have mounted an arbitrary and capricious challenge. That there's no basis for the rules.
But I'm not sure there's an evidentiary dispute.
I think there is also. We said in our briefs that the rules actually disincent broadband build out in terms of rather than encouraging
it. I understand that's sort of a projection on economic theory, but on hard evidence, I don't see any real dispute.
There is. We actually our amicus pointed out record evidence that we think shows that these rules will deter broadband deployment as opposed to encourage it.
That's not historical facts. Those are projections, right?
Yes, necessarily, because these are prophylactic rules.
Right. I understand. So I'm not sure there's really a hard evidentiary dispute between the two of you at all. The question is, what's the implications from the hard evidence?
Well, when the agency regulates by its own admission purely prophylactically in order to shut down an entire side of a potentially two-sided market and essentially freeze the development of commercial arrangements with respect to the internet business, I think we are necessarily...
Well, isn't it really... I hear your point about that, but isn't it... It's a balancing here, as I read it. One side says, look, if these rules are going to, as you just said very articulately, if these rules go into effect, or they are in effect, these rules will limit investment in the last mile, right? That's by broadband providers. On the other side, you have experts and witnesses who say perhaps it will, but the overall internet will be benefited overall by the positive consequences that will flow from prohibiting any discrimination at all against edge providers. That the investment that will come from that will counterbalance and produce a better system than the limitations on the other side, in the two-sided market. And so the Commission said, we've listened to both sides, and we've decided that restricting discrimination against edge providers is more beneficial, even if it results in some restrictions on investment by internet providers.
I think that would have been fine, Judge Tatel, had the agency had a warrant from Congress to actually adopt rules like this. I mean, that is what you posit with a perhaps pre-existing, sufficiently clear grant of authority is a classic case for Chevron deference. But the problem here is they don't even have the necessary existing prior valid grant of authority from Congress in the first place.
I'm going to go into a step that I think we all want to listen to, which is, let's assume we agree with you flat out with respect to your common carriage argument.
Yes.
That which is drawn from a recent opinion by one of the more scholarly judges on our court. Another Baldwin judge.
More room for brains, Your Honor.
In his most articulate description of what is common carriage. Let's assume we agree with you on that.
Yes.
Which would mean that the anti-discrimination, the requirement to carry free, all would go.
Correct.
Those part of the rules would go.
Everything would go, the entire order.
Well, that's my question. Is there anything that would remain? What about the transparency rule?
Well, this...
That would depend on 706, wouldn't it?
Actually...
Does that go because of common carriage?
The transparency rule they based on 218, which is the collection of information from common carriers. So actually, if you find that we are being regulated as common carriers, then 218 couldn't apply.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
So Judge Silberman, I just wanted to make that clarification. The larger point is the order is not severable. The order does not contain a severability clause. The FCC has not contested severability, even though it was explicitly raised in our opening briefs. They have not asked this court for that relief. All they could bring themselves to say in their SIR reply was that if Title III applied here, the mobile rules would still be lawful, with a long pregnant pause after that. They didn't say the rules are severable.
I thought, incidentally, the common carriage barrier would apply with respect to the mobile, too.
The common carriage ban, if you believe, and I'd like to talk about that.
Doesn't it apply equally to the
mobile? It applies to mobile as well as fixed. I was addressing the point that the order is not severable, but yes, actually the narrowest ground here, we believe, is the common carrier ground, which the commission has not really contested on the merits. That's a very important distinction from Selco, Judge Tatel. The commission here, neither in the order...
Yeah, I noticed that. I was going to ask them about that in their brief, actually.
Yeah,
that's a very good point.
Yeah.
I plan to ask them.
But
can I just pursue Judge Sullivan's question just briefly, which is that I want to ask you about the difference between, with respect to your common carrier argument, with respect to the anti-blocking and the anti-discrimination part of it. Let's assume that we thought the anti-discrimination rules did run afoul of the common carrier prohibition. Does the anti-blocking rule by itself do that?
Well, as set forth in this...
That's all there was.
Well, it's not all there is, Your Honor, because in paragraph 64 of the order, the agency also sets forth the no charging of edge providers rule as a corollary to the no blocking rule, and that's a large part of what is causing us our harm.
I thought that was in the anti-discrimination.
Nope, it's pursuant to the no blocking rule. They say it would be tantamount to blocking if you charged edge providers to reach the end users. It is a corollary of the no blocking rule in the order.
And furthermore, if you're allowed to charge, which I'm assuming you're allowed to charge because of the anti-common carrier plan, if somebody refused to pay, then just like in the dispute between CBS and Warner, Time Warner,
right,
you could refuse to carry.
If we were not under these rules, we can't, right?
No. But assuming,
in a free market, we could.
Assuming they don't counter the common carrier.
Absolutely.
Then it seems to me, if that's true, the anti-blocking rule has to go too, because if you're allowed to charge and somebody refuses to pay,
absolutely,
you should be able to block.
Absolutely. We have no right to terminate service under these rules. No right to terminate service
even
at all.
Even if somebody refuses to pay.
Exactly. No right to terminate service, not provided for anywhere in these orders. We have to carry the traffic no matter what.
Maybe we ask the commission. I read this as saying that you can't use charge to block, but you can charge for different kinds of services. Is that not right under the anti-blocking rule that you can't degrade it or charge in such a way that it makes it unusable, but you can still charge, assuming we strike the anti-discrimination rule. I read this as saying that you can charge for different kinds of services.
Paragraph 67, which is in the section regarding the no blocking rule for fixed providers, says to the extent that a content application or service provider could be avoided being blocked only by paying a fee, charging such a fee would not be permissible under these rules.
Well, if that's true, why do they need the anti-discrimination rule?
I think what this does is it basically prohibits price discrimination. The charge will be zero, and you may not deviate from that. And then they wanted to say explicitly, just to put a cherry on top, that with respect to the transmission of traffic, you can't favor some traffic over another. There shall be no favoritism, which is, of course, a fundamental element of common carrier regulation, the prohibition against any favoritism in the transmission of traffic. Could I talk about Selco?
I just wanted to ask you a question. You know, the
yes.
interveners raised a question about your standing. And one of the questions I had is, what showing have you made that this is, if I can put it in Judge Silverman's terms, a market that Verizon is in, namely contracting with edge providers?
Under Sierra Club.
Because edge providers have requested carriage by Verizon.
Under Sierra Club, we have self-evident standing because we are the object of the orders on review. And interveners cite Lujan, of course, which is a case about third parties who were not even regulated by the government action at issue, so that was frivolous.
Take it as a factual question.
Yes. Well, as I was saying to Judge Silberman, what the agency has done here is shut down and prevent the development of a two-sided market with respect to internet services. There is evidence in the record that edge providers are contracting with broadband providers where actually they demand payment ESPN has a website that is so popular that ESPN demands and receives payments from broadband providers in order to allow those subscribers to access the ESPN content. So the market's there, certainly in that regard, and I'm authorized to state by my client today that but for these rules, we would be exploring those commercial arrangements. But this order prohibits those and, in fact, will shrink the types of services that will be available on the Internet.
Counsel, isn't it sufficient to say that we have always held that a party regulated, potentially regulated by a rule,
yes,
always has standing,
yes,
to challenge it? This is not an adjudication. For instance, the last case you argued you didn't have standing because it was an adjudication. You were a third-party complaint, you recall that. But this is a rule.
We didn't reach that question, remember.
Yes. To Judge Rogers' standing point, Sierra Club disposes of that.
All
it was
right.
Frivolous to cite Lujan. But to answer her factual question, there would be a market were it not for these rules, and my client wants the freedom to explore that. On Selco, I was going to say that it's not actually a very difficult case on the common carrier issue. In Selco, Judge Tatel, you held, after refining a lot of circuit and other precedent on this issue, that if a carrier is forced to offer service indiscriminately and on general terms, then that carrier is being relegated to common carrier status. We meet that test.
Okay. Can I go back to 706 for just a second, just to follow up on a question that I wanted to ask you?
Yes.
When I get interrupted, which is that let's assume we thought, this is only a hypothetical, I promise, let's assume we thought that 706 was ambiguous.
I'm sorry, A or B?
Together. That they were ambiguous, that the statute was ambiguous.
Okay.
Did I hear you saying, under those circumstances, you concede that the commission's balancing of the evidence was okay?
No.
Oh.
Even if 706 A or B were ambiguous, that is not sufficient under Brown and Williams and Gonzalez, MCI, in cases of that line that say explicitly that in cases like that, mere ambiguity is not enough for a court to conclude that Congress meant to impliedly delegate authority. We require
more. But you conceded at the outset, if you had market power, 706 could be read legitimately to authorize the FCC to take action to deal with market power because that would discourage broadband development.
If they were really, Your Honor, directing their action toward the removal of barriers to infrastructure investment and even purporting to be encouraging broadband deployment, it's just an after-the-fact rationalization that that's really what they're doing. These rules are meant to regulate the Internet as a means of communication in and of itself. It's just bootstrapping. It's bootstrapping three times over.
Bootstrapping, as you conceded at the outset, if there was market power.
I think what
because if you had market power, let's say Verizon had market power across the country, it was the only broadband provider, it certainly would be legitimate for the FCC to conclude that regulating that or remedying that would encourage other broadband providers to get in the market.
If I conceded that, then that was an error because I think all the other arguments still apply that are in our briefs. All the general points that I said apply to all of these provisions. You'd have to overcome all of those problems.
No, then it would just 706 would apply, as I see it.
706 suffers from all the overarching problems, whether we're talking about A or B.
Well, that Brown and Williamson argument is basically a policy argument, isn't it?
It's a legal argument about...
And just because the Supreme Court bought it, it became a legal argument?
It's a legal argument based at what courts will consider at step one to divine congressional intent, which is the whole point of Chevron and of every statutory construction case. And Judge Rogers, your opinions have been very clear on this, that we look not just at language in isolation. We look at the structure of the act. We look at other parts of the act. We even look at legislative history. We look at subsequent legislation, which is what our amicus pointed out. And we look at the consistent position of the agency, which is it has no direct authority. And all of a sudden, 10 years later, after the first classification order, poof, it discovers direct implied authority that apparently had been hiding in plain sight all along. That undermines the credibility of their argument in a very real world way.
All right. Why don't we hear from the commission?
Good Thank you, Judge Rogers, and may it please the Court. Sean Lev for the FCC. The Commission's decision here is firmly grounded in the relevant statutes, particularly 706A and 706B. It's also consistent with this Court's precedents, with the Commission's prior decisions, and with the legislative history and the context of the statute, all of the things that Ms. Walker has suggested we should look at. I'd like to start with the plain text of 706A. Ms. Walker seems to find in it a limitation to authority granted elsewhere in the statute. It doesn't say that. It says the Commission shall, quote, use measures that promote competition in the local telecommunications market or other regulating methods that remove barriers to infrastructure investment.
What about the reference to state commissions?
The reference to state commissions is interesting. It actually says state commissions with regulatory jurisdiction over telecommunications services. Mm-hmm. In 1996, when the statute was passed, these services were understood to be telecommunications services. State commissions did have authority over those as to intrastate elements, so it was not unusual that Congress would refer to that. But in particular, as to the federal government, I think it's important to realize that in the same statute where Congress passed this provision, it also passed, for instance, Section 257, where Congress was very clear that was not granting additional authority. It's a similar provision in many ways. It says, this is 47 U.S.C. 257A, the Commission shall complete a proceeding for the purposes of identifying and eliminating by regulations pursuant to its authority under this chapter, then parenthetical, other than this section. And then it goes on. Mm-hmm. Congress knew how, and it does it in other places. In fact, in Comcast, Your Honor, the Court discussed Section 257 and other provisions that were explicit in not granting additional authority.
Counsel, if I might ask you to go to what I think the Court, perhaps the majority of the Court, perceive as the biggest barrier to you.
Sure.
Is the prohibition against regulating in a common carriage market.
Absolutely, I'll address that directly. I think it's important to understand that Verizon sometimes talks about the relationship or the carrying something for the edge provider. It used ESPN.com. Verizon doesn't carry anything for an edge provider. The only request here is from the end user Verizon is free to serve.
Oh, any difference from Midwest Video 2?
Oh, because in Midwest Video 2, Verizon, the equivalent of Verizon, they're the cable company, had, let's say, 100 channels. And it had to decide. It had contracts with the 100 providers, right? And how am I going to divide up these channels? They had economic relationships, and the Court said, you can't say you have to take 20 of those channels and do them first come, first serve.
But those content providers were exactly the same position as the edge providers here?
No, they're not, Your Honor, because here's how it works. The edge providers have their own internet access provider, and Verizon doesn't.
That's true, but that just means there's an intermediate market.
No,
that doesn't mean there's no market.
There are millions of edge providers out there. It's just like, let's say I want to call my father in Colorado, okay? And imagine the rule in an ordinary voice call was I'm a Verizon customer. Verizon can choose to serve me or not to serve me. Verizon can charge any rate it wants. It can charge me a different rate than Mr. Marcus. But Verizon, the one rule is Verizon, if I want to call my father, Verizon can't charge my father or his provider to connect that call.
I think you're actually dividing up common carriage to only one part of it.
No.
I'm inclined to think you run afoul of Judge Tagle's recent opinion on that.
I disagree.
Can I just continue?
I just want to continue this one thing.
Sure.
So, I mean, Judge Silverman, I think, was asking you we were talking about, this is your point that the edge providers are not, you don't have a common carrier problem because the broadband providers are not serving the edge providers, right?
They have their own broadband providers. They have the equivalent
of... Yeah, of course
they
do, but there's no way that say, Amazon can communicate with me, right, except by going through my broadband internet provider. So my broadband internet provider is serving Amazon, correct, by getting their bits to me.
No, right? Your Honor, that's the same. No, I don't believe that's so. I'm sorry. Let me explain why. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Again, let me use my hypothetical. Imagine it's a voice call.
Let's not talk about voice calls. We're talking about the internet.
Okay.
Let's talk about internet providers.
Okay.
That's our case here.
Because the edge provider is in the same position as a called party on a long-distance call, or because what happens is, in the Internet Engineers brief that you referred to talks about this in great depth, Verizon doesn't interconnect with the edge provider. If it did, by the way, its relationship would not be covered here. That's footnote 209 of the order. What happens is Verizon hands the traffic to one or many backbone providers. It could be 10. And then that is handed to a different broadband access provider that the edge provider has separately paid for the service of being connected.
Can we go back to Midwest Video
2? Yes.
Okay, just distinguish it from that for me. There, in Midwest Video 2, the local broadcasters were customers, right, of the cable operator, correct?
The local broadcasters were customers of the cable company, in the sense that the cable company had X number of channels and was deciding how to divide them up.
Yeah, and why is that any different from the edge providers, except for the fact that there's an intermediary between the two of them?
Because Verizon...
Is that the difference?
No, that's one important difference.
Why is that an important difference?
Well, because Verizon has no economic relationship with those providers,
The whole purpose of it is to prevent broadband internet providers from imposing charges on the edge providers. In other words, the commission itself acknowledges the capability and the incentive to do it.
Absolutely right.
That's the whole purpose of this.
That is correct. But let me
So how can you say, I mean, right now, in a way, they're getting the service for free from the internet, broadband internet providers. What the commission is worried about is that they're going to start charging for the service. Either way, it's hard to say they're not being served. That is, the edge providers aren't being served by the broadband providers.
Absolutely not. First of all, no one is getting the service for free. They are paying their own provider just the way I would provide.
But they're getting the service free from Verizon.
No, Your Honor,
they're
not.
They're getting access to the Verizon customers for free.
No, Your Honor, they're not.
They're not?
I mean, they're paying their own.
They're paying their own provider, Verizon.
Well, that's like saying the automobile company pays the maintenance people to come in and clean, but then they sell to the dealer. I mean, I don't understand how you can divide up the market the way you're doing.
I'm doing it that way because
helps your case.
Well, of course, but there. The economic relationships in this market, the commission is allowed to take those as they were. Is Verizon has, in the ordinary case, Verizon has an economic relationship not only with the end user, but with a backbone provider to whom it hands the traffic. That backbone
can charge everybody.
It can charge them, or Verizon can charge it.
But the backbone provider can charge everybody. The broadband provider to the edge provider can charge them. Everybody can charge everybody, but except for the broadband provider to the user. That's the only person who can't charge.
That's wrong, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Who else can charge?
Everyone can charge their own customer. Everyone can charge.
That's what I said.
Everyone can charge.
So the backbone provider can charge both ends of the market. The broadband provider to the edge provider to get to the backbone can charge, right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So everybody in this market can charge except for the broadband provider to the end user.
No. The broadband provider charges the end user. The broadband provider charges for us.
Excuse me. The broadband provider can't charge the edge provider. That's the only limitation here.
No. That is the only limitation, but yes,
you
take that's
one
correct.
Segment of the market, so that one segment can't charge.
Right. All right.
Now I want to focus on antitrust theory for a moment. Wait. You said in your brief, sort of surprised me, moreover, the commission found the threats could be exacerbated by market power. That's page 14 of your brief. That sort of omitted the proposition that the commission went out of its way to say, we are not deciding whether there's market power. Are you being a little deceptive there? That's not the way the government usually in the case.
Your Honor, I don't think there was any intent to deceive. The next sentence, I think, makes the point that I hope that...
As of December 2009, nearly 70% of households live in areas served by one?
Right.
But does that mean there was market power?
The commission did not find market power.
I know, and you omitted that.
Okay. Your Honor,
you say, moreover, the commission found the threats could be exacerbated by market power.
That sort of
suggested there was market power here. The commission went out of its way to say, we're not going to find them for this market.
I take your point. Let me explain.
Let me go on to some other evidentiary questions that trouble me. Paragraph 27.
Yes, Your Honor.
Many end users may have limited choice among broadband providers. May. Yeah, so my end user should be a trolley car. What does may mean?
Well, I think that goes back to the 70% and 20%. If 20% of Americans only have one choice, then I think it's fair to say.
But you don't make a finding that there's a limitation of choice. You say they may have limited choice.
Well, Your Honor,
kind of finding is that? Then go on. Moreover, those that can switch broadband providers may not benefit from switching if rival broadband providers charge edge providers similarly for access. That's another may. Further, end users may not know whether charges or service levels, et cetera. And the final sentence, information may find it costly to switch. So you have all these hypotheticals, but that's not a finding of anything.
Your Honor, I think, first of all, this is an exercise, as the Commission explained, of its predictive judgment based on the economic...
But it doesn't even say it will. We think it will. It may.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that the Commission, if you read this section as a whole, finds three specific economic incentives for providers to act and the ways that it could harm...
Yes, but the whole key is whether the consumer
absolutely.
Can switch easily or not easily.
And the Commission, and there is much evidence in the record that consumers had difficulty switching.
No, but your finding is only that they may have difficulty switching, not that there is difficulty.
Well, Your Honor, I think when may is used there in the sense that not every consumer would be not every consumer would face the same hurdles, but many would, and I think it's a reasonable conclusion.
You could certainly have developed evidence on that question, couldn't you?
We did. The Commission cites
evidence.
No,
there's no evidence. The conclusion is only may.
Well, I think Your Honor is reading May in a different way than I would, which is the Commission did not say all 200 million, some odd million Americans would have the same concern. The Commission was saying that these are reasonable, given the record evidence before it and its predictive judgment, these are reasonable conclusions.
Possibilities.
I think it's more than possibilities.
May
no, these are predictive
judgment.
No, I think when you're talking about the future, Your Honor, I think it's a reasonable predictive judgment to say, given what we know, given how hard it is to switch, that when you may have only one other choice, when you may have to take a day off work, when you may have to...
I didn't see a day off work.
Oh, there is a reference. There is a reference in one of these paragraphs, I apologize if I don't have it immediately, to the difficulties of switching and potentially losing email addresses and other effects.
You call the broadband provider a gateway.
A gatekeeper, absolutely. Because
gatekeeper. A retail store is a gatekeeper, right?
Not in the same way, Your Honor.
Well,
the point of the gatekeeper is, if I want to...
The SEC does not explain in what way...
Well, the Commission explains at paragraphs 26, I believe, in paragraph...
This suggestion of market power, which is inconsistent with a flat statement... that we're not going to discuss market power.
I think the Commission explained quite explicitly that its role here went beyond market power, and the Commission expressly rejected the idea that it had to provide to find market power. I'd look point in particular to footnote 141, Your Honor, and footnote 143, which talk about the antitrust issues in the Department of Justice and FTC. In both of those footnotes, what the Commission said, which is entirely reasonable, going back to the statutory language, is its goal here is not to find an antitrust violation. Its goal is affirmatively to encourage the deployment of advanced telecommunications capability. That it gives
indeed,
it to
indeed, role. The Department of Justice position here is quite inconsistent in its regulations with your rule.
Absolutely
the Department
not.
Of Justice specifically said, hey, they should focus on whether there's market power here. And otherwise, be very careful. You're going to deter investment in broadband if you regulate without focusing on market power.
Your Honor, in footnote 143, the Commission expressly addresses that, and
I've rejected the Justice Department. Essentially, they do reject the Justice Department.
I don't think that's a fair characterization. I think
I make a fair characterization? Regulation.
What the Commission said.
I make a fair characterization of what the Justice Department's position was with respect to this regulation?
The Justice Department counseled caution, particularly as to price regulation. And as Your Honor is aware, the Commission did not engage in price regulation. In paragraph 72, in particular, the Commission specifically rejected...
Wait, it's not price regulation, so you have to carry free?
No, no one is being told to carry free. They can charge whatever they want to their end users. No one is being required to charge...
Wait a minute. They can't charge the edge provider.
Well, that goes back to the question of who the customer is here, and Your Honor, I think it's reasonable for the commission to understand, and this goes back to our earlier discussion.
That's what I wanted to explore a little bit with you. The commission's focus is on the request obligation that the statute contemplates. And you said in responding to another question a moment ago that the commission in regulating is entitled to find the market as it finds it. Not using it, the word market in an antitrust sense, but just find the relationship between the parties as it finds it and regulate accordingly, assuming it has authority. I want to understand that a little bit more clearly, because the implication of that is that, well, if we were presented with an actual situation where Verizon entered into a carrying obligation with an edge provider, then we would be in a different situation than we are today, so that the so-called blocking and cutting off the two-sided market simply is not part of this case, because the statute refers to entities that request, and there is no request that is evident from the record here from an edge provider for some of the reasons that the engineers explain in their amicus brief. So can you just explain that a little bit more clearly?
Absolutely. I think it's important that the edge providers are not requesting service. No one is requesting to pay Verizon.
But Verizon's point, as I understand it, is suppose they seek business from edge providers. They say this rule prevents them from entering into contractual relationships and charging the edge providers for carriage.
Let me answer that in two ways. First of all, to the extent Verizon wants to interconnect directly with an edge provider, okay, and act as a backbone provider, that the commission is quite explicit that those relationships are not barred. It does not bar interconnection agreements. Second, it is to say that the edge provider would be requesting to pay Verizon, I think, takes the word request in a somewhat unusual way. Verizon would be saying, we're going to block you unless you pay us, because otherwise, or we're going to degrade your service unless you pay us, or we're going to have your competitor have better service unless you pay us. Those are not requests. Those may be acceding to a threat, but that is not a request. The only request here comes from the end user customer. And to go back to Selco, which Ms. Walker referred to, I think what the court said there is important. It said, even if a regulatory scheme is not so distinct from common carriage as to render it inconsistent with common carrier status, that hardly means that it is so fundamentally common carriage as to render it inconsistent with private carrier status. And in a circumstance where these relationships do not exist, where the market is one in which there are ordinarily many intermediaries, and as the engineers and the venture capitalists and others have explained, that's a core aspect of this market. For the commission to say, you can't stop blocking traffic unless you can extort a second toll from any of the millions of endpoints on the internet, that is not a core common carriage obligation. There is no record that that's how this market ordinarily works. There is no record that these parties request service. Again, any request would be unusual. They'd be requesting to pay for something that they currently pay someone else for already, which is access to the internet.
Suppose just hypothetically, we don't buy your argument that broadband providers are not carriers with respect to the edge providers, okay? I didn't see very much in your brief then about how, given that you would distinguish this, the anti-discrimination provision in here from Section 202 or the Advice Video 2, but before you answer that question, can you just explain to me or give me an answer to this debate I was having or question I was having with Ms. Walker about whether the anti-blocking provisions by themselves prohibit charging?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do they or don't they?
Well, it is in the no blocking section. I think the only way to enforce a charge is to say, if you don't pay it, we're going to block you. And that's what Verizon can threaten to do to anybody. And that's why this is so dangerous.
Suppose there wasn't an anti-discrimination provision. Suppose it was only an anti-blocking provision. Could Verizon charge somebody for faster service to its customers?
In that instance, perhaps it could.
I don't understand. Suppose then the person doesn't pay.
Well, I think what you're saying is everyone will get a certain level of service, but some people will get better service if they pay.
Yeah.
The commission found that troublesome. It didn't actually say...
No, I'm only asking about the anti-blocking provision.
I understand. Yeah. So if the commission said... I think what paragraph 67 says is if the only way you can avoid blocking is to pay, that's a violation. But if the consequence of not paying is not that you're blocked, but that you get lesser service, that's not an anti-blocking violation.
Okay, so that's the way I read it. So then, and that's, I guess, why the commission needed the anti-discrimination provision, right? Because that's what says you can't charge at all, right?
Well, no.
No.
The commission did not say, and this is in paragraph 76, the commission explained for many reasons why it may be concerned about pay for priority, different pay rates, but it did not actually find here that those would always be illegal. It says they would raise significant cause for concern, is the first sentence of paragraph 76.
But anti-discrimination, of course, prevents something beyond blocking, which is less adequate service.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's so true. That's why they're two together.
But it's only unreasonable discrimination, and there may be reasons to have
exactly
less good service, such as congestion management and other things.
Which is exactly what section 202 says, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what's the difference between the anti-discrimination provision here and section 202?
Well, Your Honor, there are also non-common carrier provisions that we pointed out in our brief that have non-discrimination provisions. I think we cited in particular section 616 of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
It is not that only common carriers are subject to non-discrimination provisions. Non-common carriers, broadcast channels, are subject to non-discrimination commissions as to political ads, for instance.
Is that what this means in this case?
Well, it means actually something less than most, because...
I mean, you're not suggesting that's the limit of this unreasonable discrimination provision.
My point is that a non-discrimination rule is not necessarily inconsistent with a finding of private carriers. There are carriers that are not providers who are not common carriers.
And then how do you distinguish it from Midwest Video 2?
Well,
operators are, I'm reading you some language from Midwest Video 2. Operators are prohibited from determining or influencing the content of programming, and the rules limit what they can charge for access and use of the equipment. Isn't that exactly this case?
No, Your Honor, because in Midwest Video 2, there were existing commercial relationships and there was a set quantum of channels. And they negotiated already with those channels, and what the rule said is as to 20% of those channels, you no longer have the right to negotiate. You have to give that on a first-come, first-basis, first-come, first-served basis.
Isn't that true here?
No, it is not.
All transmissions from edge providers?
No, Your Honor, it's not first-come, first-served.
Basically, your argument is privity, right?
It's not just privity, Your Honor. It's that there is not the limited resource that is being divided. The Internet is fundamentally different than cable service, where you have 100 channels. The Internet has, and this is part of what the engineers say, it has literally limitless number of potential destinations. You are not dividing up in the same way you were in Midwest Video 2.
From the point of view of the end user.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
From the point of view of the end user.
From the point of view of the end user.
The end user, Verizon is a bottleneck, correct? Verizon can control... That's what you're worried about, isn't it?
Yes, but as to the end user,
and
that's
you're saying Verizon can't use any of that.
No, as to the end user, Verizon can choose not to serve the end user at all. As to the end user, Verizon can say, "I'm not serving you, Mr. Lev. I'm only going to serve you if you pay $100, even though Mr. Marcus pays $50.
That's not my point.
Well, I'm sorry if I misunderstood you.
So maybe we could make more progress if we look at the language from Selco, okay?
Sure.
Selco says, if a carrier is forced, Ms. Walker read this language, if a carrier is forced to offer service indiscriminately and on general terms, then that carrier is being relegated to common carrier status. Now, is this case different from that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me how.
Because first of all, Verizon is not...
No, forget that. I told you, this is all based on the assumption we don't buy that argument.
So it's that you believe that the edge provider is the customer?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then the Verizon can't...
I mean, yes, that's the hypothetical.
Okay. I understand. You understand that I think that's
fundamentally wrong. I understand. That's why I called it a hypothetical.
I understand. I just don't want to be conceding that point.
You're not conceding anything.
Okay, thank you.
Got it.
So, as to an edge
provider,
Verizon, I apologize.
No, you shouldn't apologize. It's just, I'm not saying we necessarily agree with that part of your brief. Okay. That's all.
As to an edge provider, Verizon is free to make decisions as to the speed it wants to serve them. It can can make reasonable determinations as long as it is not discriminating in certain senses. It can.
I don't understand what that means. Does that mean that it can? For example, could it say to Google, "If you want to reach our end users, you got to pay with a faster service. It's going to cost you $200,000 a month." Could they do that?
Paragraph 76 suggests that the commission would have significant concern about that.
So what can they do?
What?
What can they do under this other than transmit to their end users all, or not transmit, but connect their end users to all edge providers on a non-discriminatory basis.
Well, again, it's subject to reasonable network management, and
right.
So there can be reasons why, for example, for congestion.
Network management.
Right.
Got that. What else?
Well, so one other thing that I think is important is that the commission didn't actually decide this point. Paragraph 76 said the commission would have significant concern. It did not say that it would never be allowed. And the commission, I think, did point to a significant reason why, given Section 706, you would want to dissuade Verizon from being able to do this. Because if Verizon could do this, what Verizon would have an incentive to do is to create congestion, to create the traffic jam so that people would pay to get out of it, and then would not invest in facilities, which is the opposite.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if there's any possibility that Verizon is free to negotiate different terms with edge providers, as it was in Selco,
yes.
If there's any basis for that, then I truly don't understand why the commission developed these rules. I thought the whole purpose of the rule was to ensure that all edge providers had free and unfettered access to the Internet.
I think that is one of the reasons why the commission indicated it had significant concern.
So then explain to me where there is any room for the kind of negotiation that that allowed the digital roaming arrangements in Selco to survive.
I think the answer is that...
Where is it?
Well, I guess my point is that you have to look at this in the context that this is not actually a relationship as in the digital world.
Okay, so you're falling back to that position.
You want to fight the hypothetical.
That's it. Right.
Well, I want to be clear that the analogy is not accurate in that sense, because
my questions were all based on assuming you're wrong about that, or at least that we think you're wrong.
Okay.
And what I haven't heard from you, of the commission, I haven't seen in the brief, and I haven't heard today, which is that if that is in fact what we think, that is, that edge providers are served by Verizon, then I haven't heard a basis for distinguishing this case from the classic common carrier obligation described in Selco, the distinction that allowed the digital roaming arrangement to survive in Selco.
Well, let me say this.
Can I just get in for a moment?
Yeah.
So I don't think, I don't want to even challenge Judge Tatel's expertise on Selco. And I agree with him entirely. I'm a little concerned about the First Amendment issue that hasn't had much bearing. Suppose an edge provider is offering anybody with access lessons on how to build or construct chemical weapons to be used against the United States or against any enemy. Verizon says, we're not going to allow that edge provider to have access to our customers. Is it your view that there's no First Amendment issue when FCC says, no, you have to have free access?
I believe in that instance the security limitations on our free access would probably apply.
No. Let's not put aside the question. Assuming there's no governmental security intervention, is there a First Amendment right on the part of Verizon to say we won't carry that message?
No, Your Honor.
There's no First Amendment right.
I don't believe so. No more so than the law schools in the Fair case to believe that they were not carrying the message. Verizon is not speaking in that instance. Verizon has made clear over and over again that it's a conduit for other people's speech. No one would say.
You think in the law school case, the law schools would have been able to prevent a speaker coming, advocating violence against the United States?
Well, the difference between that is the law school hiring a speaker is different than the law school renting out a room.
No, the same thing. Well, it's the same thing as the hypothetical or the circumstance.
The Verizon is not speaking. Verizon is a conduit for other speech.
So your answer is Verizon has no First Amendment right to reject that message?
No,
yes, that's your view, because Verizon is not a speaker, therefore it has no First Amendment right to reject that message.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Verizon, so let me use a different hypothetical if I might. If I went to the WashingtonPost.com today and there was a specific story about the Redskins game tonight and Robert Griffin III, and I disagreed with the story, I would never say, what crazy thing did Verizon say today? Just like I would not say, what a crazy thing Verizon said about how to build a chemical
Verizon,
weapon.
But suppose Verizon has got its own content, which of course is true of Comcast.
And Verizon is allowed to have its own content that is not regulated by this rule.
I understand, but its content is different from the edge provider, or it's hostile to the edge provider.
It is certainly free to put that.
It's nonetheless forced to carry the edge provider.
Verizon has obtained immunity, and I think the Hunt brief collects all the instances.
But what about that hypothetical? Verizon has its own content. Let's assume it has its own content, and the content of the edge provider is absolutely hostile.
And Verizon is not speaking as in connecting you to an edge provider.
In other words, you're dividing Verizon into two parts.
Yes.
One part is acting as a common carrier, and one part is acting as a speaker.
Verizon has many roles. Verizon has websites.
In other words, one is a common carrier, one is
not
a speaker.
Not as a common carrier, no.
Well, essentially, it's
a conduit. A conduit, Your Honor.
A conduit that's and not a common carrier.
Well, in fact, and the amicus briefs go into the fact that parties can be conduits. The Will brief, in particular, goes into the fact that parties can be conduits, but not conduits.
Of course, you don't have to reach the First Amendment issue under certain circumstances.
That's right. I'd like to go back to the common carriage issue, because to go back to what Judge Tatel was saying, I think if you look at footnote 229, for instance, the Commission made clear that it was not making a firm determination at this point on the pay-for-priority issue, on the issue of whether there are instances where these agreements could happen. I do think, however, Your Honor, that it is to suggest that any time Verizon wants to enter an agreement with anybody, whether it has any current economic or technical relationship with that party, to say that you can't do that because that would block someone else's call, that is not core common carriage. I just really want to come back to the instance of blocking someone.
What saved digital roaming in Zelco was that the commercially reasonable arrangements, right? There was flexibility in there. The Commission had these 16 different factors, correct?
Right.
Okay. Where is that flexibility here? The Commission has used the language of 202. Unreasonable discrimination, and I don't see anywhere in the order or in your brief where Verizon would have any flexibility at all other than reasonable network management practices negotiate anything with edge providers.
Well, the Commission said only unreasonable discrimination, and it pointed to various indicia of unreasonable discrimination. It did not say that anything in particular was or was not. Okay. So it talked about use agnostic, end user control, transparency, telling providers. This is paragraph 69 through 74 of the order. So it's not the case that the Commission said that there was a flat ban on anything. It said that these are factors that we will look at.
So you're telling us now on behalf of the Commission that it's reasonable, that it's possible under the new rule, that Verizon could enter into exactly the kind of negotiations that Ms. Walker said these rules prohibit them from doing with edge providers?
I want to be candid. We said that they may raise significant cause for concern, but the commission did not rule on that particular hypothetical of any specific circumstance. This is, of course, a facial challenge. And that, as in Selco, the court acknowledged that there's
a
difference.
Then why did the commission issue these rules?
Well, because there's two different things, right? One is the threat of blocking, and second, they provide guidance as to practices that are likely or not likely to be permissible, and to provide, and the very uncertainty as to those practices was one of the barriers to investment. I think the venture capitalists and others have identified that the threat of what Verizon and other parties could do was, in fact, a barrier to infrastructure investment.
The whole theory of the rule, as I understand it, is that any chance that the broadband providers will charge ad providers will threaten and restrict investment, which will limit the growth of the internet, correct?
I think the commission is certainly
That's
concerned
the whole
about
theory
that.
Of this.
The commission is certainly concerned about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if that's not the theory of it, then I don't understand this case. Yeah. That's the theory of the case. But now I hear you saying to me, well, yeah, that's our theory, but don't pay any attention to that because Verizon still may be able, under these rules, to do all the things that those who raise concerns about charging edge providers are worried.
No, I don't mean to be saying that. Don't go
beyond what you're, you know, I mean, I know, yeah. You know, you're arguing your case as well as you can, but you're defending the rule you've got.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's why.
And that's the rule you've got to defend, and you haven't shown me, or at least I haven't seen so far anywhere, where the kind of flexibility is that was in Selco. Where is it? Other than you say, well, they still might be able to do it.
Your Honor,
unreasonable discrimination. Is that where it comes from?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, and, you know, one of the, let me see if I can find this, one of the commenters, in response to a commenter who said this is just, it's too uncertain. The commission says in the order, well, take a look at, you know, for 75 years we've interpreted the word unreasonable in 202, and that's provided all the reliability and consistency we need. In other words, you've sent us right back, the commission has sent us right back to the word unreasonable in 202.
Let me say just a couple of things, and yeah. I don't want to belabor the point. I have no intention to go beyond the order.
Okay.
I think what paragraph 76 says about these is the commission would have significant concern. I do not want to suggest that I'm undermining the rationale of what the commission said. The commission identified that it would have significant concern with these relationships. It is not I'm not in any way suggesting that the commission said that this was not part of its part of its concern. Second, as to unreasonable discrimination in section 202, this court said in Selco that the fact that that there is a commonality along one point with common carriage does not mean that the relationship itself is a common carriage relationship. This relationship is only started, it's unique in that it's only started when the end user makes a request. There is no separate relationship. The question is when
That's
the end user.
Back to your basic
I understand that. It
let,
is back to my basic point.
You've got your point.
Yeah. Let me just ask you the same question Judge Silverman asked Ms. Walker about the consequences of different kinds of rulings here. But before I do, I want to be totally sure I understand the difference between anti-blocking and anti-discrimination. You're telling me that this sentence in paragraph 67, which says to the extent that a service provider could avoid being blocked only by paying a fee, charging such a fee would not be permissible, this is what you're telling me it means, I think, that just applies to blocking. It does not prohibit the Verizon, we'll just use that for short here, from charging for edge providers for different levels of service, like faster service or something like that, right?
I think you're right in the sense that
if the court were to knock out the anti-discrimination provision, the anti-blocking provision would be limited to preventing Verizon from actually blocking access to the internet as opposed to charging for different kinds of services.
I think that's correct, but let me say
one more
thing. I still don't understand that. How can if you're allowed to charge and somebody refuses to pay, how can it, and it's perfectly legal to charge, how can it be illegal to block at that point?
I think it's the questions of the consequences of refusing to pay. In one
instance,
in one instance, you would still get service, but not at the at the faster rate. In the other instance, you would not get any service at all, if I understand Judge Davis.
Are you saying that, hypothetically, if it's illegal to prevent the broadband provider from charging, it is nevertheless illegal for the broadband provider to enforce his charge by refusing to carry unless the other provider pays?
Well, let me
answer that either yes or no.
Well, I don't want to know the reason. If you have an agreement with you,
let's assume I'm the broadband provider. Okay. You're the edge provider. Let's assume hypothetically I'm legally charged. I'm legally entitled to charge you because we have concluded otherwise. You're coming out with a common carriage problem. So I'm entitled to charge. You refuse to pay. You say no, I'm not going to pay. Are you saying then under this rule I'm not allowed to block?
Well,
yes or no.
I believe the answer is no, and the reason is
I'm not. Yes, I'm not allowed to block, even though you're refusing to pay.
You would not be allowed to block. What you would be allowed to do is not charge. What I understand Judge Tatel to be asking is, can I get speed A for free, or can I pay more?
That's a different speed question.
Well, that was my question.
That was my only question. That was why I was trying to answer.
Your answer to my question is, you would get the regular service. You just wouldn't get the faster service.
I think
and
that's.
And if they said, well, we don't want your service at all, your answer is, well, that's your choice, but it's not blocking.
That's correct.
Okay.
Wait a minute. I understand if the edge provider refuses to pay at all under the rule, the broadband provider may not block.
That's what paragraph 67 says, that if it, the consequences of refusing to pay is blocking.
If it's illegal to prevent the edge provider from charging, how can it be illegal to prevent the edge provider from blocking if the customer refuses to pay?
I think it depends on what the background rule is. Do you have to pay for any service, or do you have to pay only for better service? And that's the non-discrimination versus the block.
Okay, so right now they're not paying, correct? Edge providers don't pay. Verizon anything, right? So Verizon, there's two possibilities. Verizon says to Google, if you want faster service, you pay us X dollars a month. If Google says no, they still have access to the Verizon customers, correct? But not at the faster service, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Another possibility is Verizon could say to Google, you know, if you want to reach our customers at all, you need to pay us $200,000 a month. And they say we won't pay, that's blocking.
Right.
Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Now,
Ms. Walker could go back to her clients now and tell them that even under the anti-blocking rule, they can charge for different services, right? Because she didn't seem to understand that, and I didn't either until you stood up here.
Well, that's how I understand the difference between paragraph 67 and 76.
Right. So my question is this. Suppose we were to find that the anti-discrimination provisions ran afoul of the provisions prohibiting the commission from treating internet broadband providers as common carriers, but that the blocking, but that there was statutory authority for the other two provisions, disclosure and blocking. What would we do? Does it all have to go back to the commission?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. There are separate rules. There's a separate no blocking.
The commission, I mean, you've told us affirmatively in your brief that mobile is separate from fixed.
Absolutely.
But you didn't say anything about the components.
Well, I would say, if I might answer, Ms. Walker does not distinguish in her argument between the no blocking and the non-discrimination. So we responded to the argument the way it was made. In other words, she attacks just as much on common carriage grounds the mobile rules, which, as Your Honor just said, only impose no blocking. Clearly, we would disagree, obviously, for the reasons I've said, with any a decision that non-discrimination is not allowed under our rules. But it is separate than no blocking. It's a separate principle. It functions separately. The commission may
I do not understand that. if at one point you say you can't charge anything, which is true, the rules say you can't charge, right? The broadband providers cannot charge yet providers a dime, nothing.
Right now,
that is correct, is it not?
It's subject to paragraph 76, which
yes,
suggests
is,
right
yes,
significant
yes,
concern
oh,
with this.
I suppose there's something along yes, the sir. Line about too much traffic at a time or something like
well,
that.
Not only that, but I don't
but,
think.
But was it basically the rule says the broadband provider cannot go to the edge provider and say, look, to reach my customers, I'm going to charge you X percent. You can't do that, right?
But that's because of the anti-discrimination rule,
oh,
right?
No, it's a, yeah, okay.
Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so now, if the edge provider says, I think that's ridiculous, I refuse to pay, are you saying under these rules, it would still be legitimate, assuming the discrimination is illegal, it would still be legal for the FCC to refuse to allow the broadband provider to block?
Yes.
Well, how else can they enforce their payment?
Because it's the background rule is that you get some level of access, but you can be asked to pay for a better level of access.
So
if
as
I understand
a matter of law, this regulation requires some level of access,
well,
which is another way, which runs afoul of the common carriage point.
No, I don't believe
now,
so.
Assuming the common carriage problem.
Right.
Assuming the argument of the common carriage problem. No. How can you tell a businessman that he must serve a customer who refuses to pay?
Because, I mean, a couple of points, right?
Yeah.
Discrimination and blocking are distinct.
No, I'm just asking, how can you tell
because still
that if a businessman is entitled to charge, which you have to assume hypothetically now, the businessman is entitled to charge, how can you tell the businessman you must serve the customer, even if the customer refuses to pay?
I don't think we've said that the businessman is entitled to charge.
No, that's the hypothetical.
Okay, but I don't understand. With all respect, Your Honor, I don't think the commission has said, nor the no-blocking rule implies an entitlement to charge.
Wait a minute. Follow me the hypothetical. This is needlessly confusing. Our understanding of the rule, which we think is dubiously legally, at least so far the dialogue is suggesting, is it requires the broadband provider to carry to its customers the content of the edge providers free. And hypothetically, that's a problem under common carriage prohibitions. Okay, assume that. Now, how can you separately say, even if that's true, even if it's true that anti-discrimination is illegal, it's still appropriate for the commission to say the businessman, the broadband provider, must provide service even if the customer refuses to pay.
So here would be the example I think I would give. It is not common carriage because even
oh,
if...
Oh, I know you're still arguing
no,
the common carriage.
No, it's not common carriage to simply have a basic level of required service if you can negotiate different levels with different people.
Correct. That's exactly right.
So that's what I'm trying to say.
But separating the anti-blocking from the anti-discrimination provisions, it's the anti-discrimination provision, isn't it, that prohibits that from happening?
I think that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
To the extent that it is prohibited is the only
it's
point
from
I would
that.
Make. To the extent it is prohibited
right.
in paragraph 76 suggests that the commission would have significant concern, and I would note that this is a facial challenge and that there is no record here of anyone actually having made that request. So, and I do believe, and I'm not going to belabor the court's
okay.
time on the other. I've obviously
yeah,
gone well
I
over my
that.
Time.
Yeah,
I'm happy to answer any further questions from the court.
Thank you. We will hear from counsel for interveners.
May it please the court, Pantelis Michalopoulos for interveners. Most Americans who watch a movie on Netflix or buy cheap phone calls from Vonage must rely for their internet access on a company that would like to sell them a show or phone service instead. Most Americans who watch this video programming remotely by means of a Sling box must rely for their internet access on a company that would supply them its own programming package. And so internet access providers have the incentive and the ability to discriminate against many Open Internet Coalition members. And to Judge Silberman's series of questions about market power, while the FCC did not make an explicit market power finding, it did find, as a matter of fact, that 70% of households in 2009 had only two broadband access providers. And so the FCC reasonably concluded that this fear of discrimination is a barrier to infrastructure investment, both in the core and at the edge of the internet. And those are two kinds of investment that mutually reinforce one another, as Verizon has conceded in a February 2010 letter. If Verizon were able to degrade the content of an online video provider, that provider would have to show its viewers blank screens for long periods of time, punctuated by the circle that means rebuffering instead of for lack of bandwidth, instead of a show. And there is nothing attenuated or cushioned about this impact. It's a direct blow for the ability of the edge provider to make infrastructure investments, investments that in turn do drive demand and the construction of alternative competing networks. Verizon heavily relies on the Brown and Williamson VFDA case. But the facts of that case were the reverse from those here. There, the FDA had, in the words of the Supreme Court, effectively ratified the agency's, the FDA's, view, prior view, that it didn't have jurisdiction to regulate tobacco. Here, the backdrop for the 96 Telecoms Act was the Commission's Computer 2 and Computer 3 decisions. Under Computer 3, Verizon had been subject to much more severe rules than those here. It had to reconfigure its entire network. Nor does Verizon point to any burden from the rules. It points to nothing that it had done before the rules were made and that it had to stop or change after the rules. Sure, Verizon wants to double charge end users, then turn to end providers and say, if you don't pay me, I will degrade your content. But as was debated extensively,
Verizon... Do you think these rules prohibit Verizon from doing that?
Verizon may not go to an edge provider and say, if you don't pay me, I will block your content altogether. But Verizon does have leeway to negotiate certain arrangements in terms of degrade the priority of traffic.
Under the anti-discrimination provision it does?
Yes.
Give me an example.
Right. So an example could be an association of hospitals knocks on Verizon's door and says, we really need high priority access to our content because of sensitive heart transplant operations that we want to perform. I think under the FCC's reasoning, that would not be unreasonable discrimination. But there's much more. And to your questions, Judge Tatel, the FCC does talk at paragraph 112 of the order about specialized services.
Could it say to Google, you have to pay $X a month for faster service under the anti-discrimination provision?
The answer to that would probably be no without other circumstances.
Right.
But within specialized services, it could accommodate such a Google request.
That's a different question. But do you agree with where I think Mr. Lev and I came out on the difference between anti-blocking and anti-discrimination, that if the anti-discrimination provision wasn't here, that the anti-blocking provision would bar Verizon from blocking any edge provider from its customers, but it would not prevent them from requiring them to pay a certain amount of money for a faster service?
In certain circumstances, as the one I mentioned.
I'm only focusing on the anti-blocking provision. Suppose the anti-discrimination provision weren't in rule.
All right. Under the anti-blocking provision, Verizon under 67 could not charge for not blocking.
Right, but could they charge? The service is now free. They don't pay anything, the edge provider, right, to get to Verizon's customers.
If it were a service, yes.
Yeah, right. Same hypothetical I'm asking you, okay? That's assumed that it's a service. Does that mean that if the anti-discrimination provision were in here, that that Verizon could charge Google or anybody else for faster service? In other words, Google pays nothing now to get to Verizon's customers. Under the anti-blocking provision, it would be okay for Verizon to say to Google, you pay us X dollars a month for faster service. Right?
Yes, if the anti-discrimination...
That would be okay.
If the anti-discrimination rule did not exist,
yes.
Which was a prerequisite.
Correct. Now, if the anti-discrimination rule is added, then that blocks... I don't mean to use the word block. That prohibits Verizon from making that kind of charge, right?
In many circumstances, not in all.
All right. Well, okay. All right, so is that the answer to the next question I'm going to ask you, which is that how you would distinguish this from, is that how you would argue that the Selco standard for common carriage doesn't apply to this?
Two distinctions.
It's flexibility?
Two distinctions. Yes. Plus another two.
But tell me
specialized services.
Tell me what the flexibility is.
Specialized services is a qualification because Google could, in fact, contract with Verizon within the rubric of Verizon specialized services. And that is a qualification to the discrimination rule. That's number one. Number two is use and application agnostic discrimination. And number three is the flexibility.
Could Verizon say, we're going to offer this service to Google with no other search engine?
It depends, Your Honor. Within the specialized services rubric, the answer is probably yes. In other words,
Verizon
is free.
I don't understand why the Commission adopted the rule. Maybe you can answer that. Mr. Leff couldn't. Why did they adopt the rule? You started your argument by telling us that what you're worried about, right, is Internet providers imposing fees on edge providers, correct?
Yes.
That's what's going to restrict investment and risk the development of the broadband, right? Now you're telling me that under the rules they can charge that.
Well, and the
so
open.
So why did they do this?
Well, it does provide a degree of protection. Of course, the Open Internet Coalition would have wanted more protection, but it is a fact that within the Fios specialized service platform, if that's what Fios is, Google could enter into a preferential agreement with Verizon. And that is a factor such as the Selco factor that distinguishes...
Wait, under these rules it could?
Yes.
It could enter into a preferential arrangement with Google to do what?
To be carried on Fios, the specialized service platform of Verizon.
That just makes our reading of the rule. That's certainly not what the FCC said.
Right.
Well, in paragraph 112, the FCC did say that we will exempt specialized services.
That's hardly Google asking for a preference over other search engines.
On specialized service platforms, there could be such a preferential arrangement. The FCC said it would monitor those and might take further action, but it is an exception and a factor
what's
that
a specialized,
makes...
Give me an example. Is that your hospital case?
The hospital case could be an example. The Fios video platform is another one.
And how would that work?
A programmer goes to Fios or Google or whoever goes to a content provider goes to Fios and say, I want you to carry me. Fios says yes to one provider, no to another. And that is legal today.
Isn't Fios cable television?
It is cable television, but it is also a specialized service.
I thought we were talking about the Internet here.
It does use...
We're not talking about cable television.
Fios does use Verizon's IP network.
I know, but we're only talking about Verizon with respect to its delivery of Internet access services, not Fios.
Yes, well, Verizon...
Maybe it runs it across... Is your point that when you have Internet service from Verizon, it comes across their Fios cable? Is that the point?
It may come across a specialized service subset...
No, don't go there, please. This is hard enough... You agree this case is not about cable television, right? It's about internet service.
Yes, correct. It's about, correct, except there are over-the-top. There are over-the-top applications that could include multi-channel.
But if I'm getting, if someone's sitting in their living room, okay, and they have their television on, and they're getting their TV signals through Fios, right? And their computer on, and they're getting their internet through their wireless connection to Verizon, right? The latter is what's controlled by this rule, not the former.
Well, they could get their Fios service as an over-the-top service over Verizon's internet access network on the computer as well. And that's a specialized service.
Okay, but that's different from what we're talking about. We're talking about just straightforward internet service.
Yeah,
Verizon so let me go back to my question. Yeah. Setting aside Fios, could Verizon say to Google, or not to Google, to, I don't know, yeah, we're Google, we've been talking about Google, for X amount of money, we're going to give you special access to our users, and we're not going to give that to anybody else. Under this rule.
Within a specialized service offering, a new specialized service offering, that might be possible, yes. And let me, if I may...
specialized service. Is the answer then no?
I'm sorry?
The answer then would be no if it's not specialized service.
That's correct. Unless there were reasonable circumstances, such as in the hospital paradigm. But if I may go to the question of whether there is a relationship with the edge provider, which was the premise of all those questions, this is different than Midwest 2. In Midwest 2, the programming lineup, in the words of the Supreme Court in that case, the programming lineup of the cable operators was transferred from their control to the control of the public. Nothing like that is happening here. Internet is not subject to Verizon's control. Verizon just gives access based on end-user requests to slivers of content. And let me give you an example. There's a political rally, and there's a hotel that has a privileged view of the speaker. So it goes to potential end users and it says, look, I have a room, I have a balcony, I can afford you amazing vistas of this speech. It is not common carriage to say to the hotel, you cannot go to the speaker as well and say, pay me because I'm bringing viewers to your balconies. So that, I think, is the difference, or one difference, between this case and Midwest 2. And let me say one more thing about common carriage. Under Verizon's theory of the case, everything would be common carriage, because every rule says you must not do something, or you may do something else. But then it can be reworded as a zero-charge rule. You cannot charge for doing something that's required of you in the first place. But this will then make it prohibited common carrier regulation. That does fly in the face of every court decision that has looked at it, whether Brand X, which has said that the FCC does remain free to impose duties on information service providers, Salco, which does say that some common carrier aspects or marks are not sufficient to make a rule common carrier rule, and Comcast itself, which recognized the FCC's authority, even though it said that it's not plenary.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for Verizon?
I'd like to clarify the confusion about the rules, what they do.
I thought you would have thanked me for the concession. I just got you. And it didn't cost you a cent.
The no-blocking rule includes the prohibition against charging. You may not charge. That's paragraph 67. That's very clear.
Well, that's not what he said it means.
And that's why I thought I should correct.
You don't want to accept the concession you got?
Characterization. I accept your concession.
No, it's not mine. It's the commission's. The commission said that you can't block, but they can charge for faster service. And
right.
And if you don't,
right.
If you don't want it.
So they're conflating the rules, and that's why I'd like to explain.
Correct. Yes.
So paragraph 67 right. is about the no-blocking rule, right. and it says you may not charge, which creates a price of zero. Nobody doubts that that's rate regulation. Very seriously, that's a no-blocking rule. The non-discrimination rule, Mr. Lev said, well, pay for priority. We just said we had concerns about that. Here's what paragraph 76 says. It sets forth the concerns, and then it says, in light of these concerns, it is unlikely that pay for priority would satisfy the, quote, no unreasonable discrimination standard. That, I think, any broadband provider at its peril would enter into a pay for priority arrangement. And in fact, that's why we're here in this court, trying to get an answer about what we may lawfully do instead of running the risk. Judge Silverman, you've pointed out statements like this create a safe harbor for regulated entities. Nobody is going to do pay for priority. Pay for priority was the whole reason that the public interest advocates thought these rules needed to be adopted. If Mr. Lev wants to come back up and say, pay for priority is perfectly okay, my client would be delighted.
Ms. Walker, if the anti-discrimination provision is stricken,
yes.
the anti-blocking rule would not permit pay for priority, correct? That's what Mr. Lev says.
Yeah, and, but I mean, we still couldn't charge for access.
Correct, but you could, to take my hypothetical, you could say to an edge provider now, no edge providers are paying anything, right? You could say to an edge provider, if you want faster service to our customers, our end users, you pay us X dollars a month.
So some people in this area, Judge Tatel, have interpreted that as effectively no blocking. I don't want to get too technical, but there are those who think that
if you don't pay it, you just don't get the faster service, but you still have access. If they then block you because you wouldn't pay for the faster service, that would violate the anti-blocking.
Yeah, I mean, rules. If this is just a no-blocking rule, then I think that would be different, but it's still...
Well, that's what he just told us.
I'm confused, so totally. I don't understand why there is a separate hypothetical, which is, forget the faster service
right.
issue, but under these rules, Verizon could not go to the edge provider and say, we're not going to give you access to our customers unless you pay a minimum fee.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
That's blocking.
It's clear that if the edge provider refused under the two provisions, you could not refuse to carry.
That's correct.
You could not block.
Under the no-blocking rule, you cannot ask for any payment.
But that's all you need is a no-blocking rule to deal with that problem. You don't need the anti-discrimination. The commission doesn't need that.
That's right. Judge Tatel's correct because the anti-discrimination right. prevents the providing a service to one edge provider that's better than the other.
Yeah, I mean, these rules do both things. They say it's tantamount to blocking to exact a fee, and then in terms of levels of service, you can't engage in any favoritism on that front.
But for our purposes, I mean, what we're asking you to do is to separate. In your brief, you treat them the same.
Right.
And I'm trying to unpack the two of them and make sure I understand how they function. And I take it you agree now that they do function differently. That is, that the anti-blocking rules, they block, and what the anti-discrimination rules add to that is that not only can't you block, but now you can't charge for faster service to some people because you have to serve everyone without discrimination.
So
without the latter...
Well, actually, our theory is that the no-blocking rule, which also, by the way, applies to wireless, itself imposes a form of non-discrimination, and that is no price discrimination. If we can't block and everybody gets a price of zero, and that's a uniform price, that in itself is a non-discrimination requirement because just like common carriers, we may not deviate from the price of zero.
I don't see how that does that. What I read the anti-blocking rule is saying is that you can't, to take Jeff Silverman's hypothetical, you can't say to Google, you have to pay us X dollars a month or we're going to block you from our end users. That they can't do. But you can say, we have a deal for you, Google. Right now you don't pay anything to get to our edge providers, I mean our end users, but to give us some more money per month, we're going to give you faster service. That you can still do. That's what Mr. Lev says this means. And that's the way 67 reads, if you think about
We can't do it, though, under paragraph 76.
The anti-discrimination.
Correct.
Exactly. That's why they're separate. So, see.
But.
So you're.
They work together.
I think the point is that they, yes, I'm just trying to clarify because Mr. Lev was conflating the two and suggesting that, you know, we were, or actually, I think, inaccurately describing the non-discrimination rule. And to the extent that there's some flexibility under a no unreasonable discrimination standard, that's just because all common carriers may only engage in reasonable discrimination in the first place. This is just like Midwest Video 2, Judge Tatel, and Selco.
Right.
In Midwest Video 2, it wasn't the viewers and their relationship with cable companies that was being regulated. It was the third parties who wanted access to the facilities to reach the viewers, and that is exactly what we have here. The edge providers here stand in the shoes of the third parties in Midwest Video 2. Under Selco, you stressed repeatedly that there was room for individualized negotiation. Here, there's nothing to negotiate with any edge provider.
Right, but suppose
you must carry them and at a price of zero.
But suppose the anti-discrimination provisions were not there. Mm-hmm. You would have that flexibility under the anti-blocking provision, correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
But I think that leads us to a brief conversation about severability.
Yes, I thought maybe you'd get into that. I didn't even have to ask the question.
We have no indicia of agency intent that these rules be severable. That was an important concern for you and Judge Rogers in the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters case. There is no severability clause in the order. The agency has not sought that relief in this court. It could not even bring itself to say that in its SIR reply. Mr. Lev didn't even say today at the podium that the rules are severable. No agency intent whatsoever. And then, under the broadcasting case, we look also to whether the rules could function sensibly if they were severed from each other. They cannot. The commission made clear that all of these rules, whether you want to separate out blocking from non-discrimination or fixed from wireless, had to work together. Wireless, they said, should be regulated more lightly than fixed, so it would be absurd to think that they would have regulated wireless without regulating fixed. And if you go back to your point, Judge Tatel, to all the reasons why the commission adopted these rules, they were concerned not just about ultimate access to end users, but they were also concerned about creating a first-class type of service that might overtake the other services or not be available to everybody on what kind of a basis? A uniform common carriage style basis. So the purposes, even if you accept the commission's theory about why this was necessary, they actually needed all of this to preserve the open internet, as they say, a service that is equally available to all people on exactly all of the same terms. So I think for this court to essentially blue pencil the order would really be an extraordinary act and outside this court's typical practice.
Well, right? I do say in its reply that the mobile can stand separately from the fixed.
Well, what they said was that if Title III supplied authority here,
the mobile rules would be lawful. I see your point.
That seems to me to really beg the question of whether they could operate separately from the fixed rules, and they haven't said it.
Your point anyway is the common carriage prohibition applies to mobile as well.
Fully applies, yes. Our argument works, I think, on both scores.
Well,
I think you understand that.
But is that right? Excuse me. Only the anti-blocking provision applies to mobile.
Well, right? Our argument is, and I think this is accurate, that the no-blocking rule that applies to wireless, and if we can't charge for access, then that's a no-payment, and that's a zero price, and setting a price of zero is requiring non-discrimination in price terms. Just like in a tariff, the price is zero, and we may not deviate from that.
But don't they work the same as a fixed? In other words, maybe you can correct me about this. Under the mobile rules, which only have anti-blocking, I assume Verizon can't block Google from your users' phones?
On wireless, we cannot.
But it could charge for faster service. In other words, if you want to reach them faster, you pay us X dollars a month.
We think it's unclear if the commission would like to say that we may do that on the wireless side. I think we would welcome that.
Well, I think Mr. Lev's statement about the fixed side has to apply to the wireless side. There's really no difference. We could ask him to tell us that if you want.
But I still am puzzled as to why that would be a crucial point, because there's still the question as to whether under either mobile or fixed, the broadband provider can charge for any service, zero service. In other words, I will not allow you to reach my customers unless you pay X amount.
Right.
That's the anti-blocking rule.
Correct.
And that means you have to, the anti-blocking rule by itself means you have to carry the edge providers free.
Which means all edge providers ride at a price of zero, and that is exactly what happened in Midwest Video 2. All those who wanted to use the least access channels could walk into the cable company's office, knock on the door, and say, hi, we're here. We want to use these channels to reach viewers,
so then I do not understand.
And we get this for free. And
Excuse me, counsel. Then I do not understand how there can be any daylight between the two rules. That is to say, I cannot understand if common carriage prohibits FCC from imposing a restriction on the broadband provider of charging for access to the end user, then it seems to me inevitable the anti-blocking rule is illegal under either the mobile or the fixed, without even going to their non-discrimination.
That was certainly the theory of our brief, which is that a simple no blocking and thou shalt not charge in order to ensure access by itself satisfied Cellco, and that the explicit non-discrimination standard was just icing on the cake.
That's
it was the kicker.
I thought it was.
Now, I think our biggest concern is the price of zero on both sides and the non-discrimination mandate. No blocking, a pure no blocking rule. My clients have no interest in blocking anybody.
Under the anti-blocking rule, there is a uniform price of zero, but you can charge more for faster service. That's what Mr. Lev says this means. You can't do that under the non-discrimination provision. That's why you...
Yes.
In other words,
that's correct.
Yeah. In other words, if the anti-blocking provision blocked both blocking and charging for more faster service, you wouldn't need the anti-discrimination provision.
Well, I think
it's the anti-discrimination provision that has the hardest problem for the commission with respect to common carriage. I mean, that seems classic common carriage.
I wholly agree that you can't offer preferential forms of service
under the anti-discrimination provision.
Yes,
but if that's knocked out,
right?
You can under the anti-blocking, and then if that's true,
right.
Ms. Walker, wouldn't that provide the flexibility that saved digital roaming? Same thing.
I think you would need to eliminate the rule against discrimination, and
correct.
I think you'd have to scrub the reference under the no-blocking rule that said you may not charge anybody for access. So if all that was left standing was a no-blocking rule, I do believe that that would be, I don't think we would be here. Right. I don't think we would be here today.
You would still be arguing.
Well,
there's no
I still don't understand that. If you could charge and somebody refused to pay, you think you would still... I don't understand.
I posited that the ban on charging for access would be struck, and that the commission would not say that it is effectively no blocking if you charge somebody, so that we could charge whatever we wanted
but
for
still,
access.
I still don't understand my proposition, which is, and I'm really totally confused by all the counsel here. I keep coming back to the proposition, if I'm legally entitled to charge and somebody refuses to pay, why can't I block?
I think we should be able to. In the world I'm positing, you would be able to.
Is the world you're positing that it's illegal for the FCC to prohibit you from blocking if your purpose of blocking is to enforce a charge which the customer, the edge provider, refuses to pay?
Yes.
All right, so why are you confusing everybody by getting into somehow different...
Well, now, let's go back to the two hypotheticals. Just two quick hypotheticals. Number one is... Verizon says to Google, we're not going to let you get to our end users without you paying X dollars a month. That's blocking, right?
If you have to pay for access.
Yeah. $200 a month, you have to pay to get to our users, right?
The commission would say that
that's blocking.
Violates the no-blocking rule.
Okay, now let's assume that there's no anti-discrimination provision in there, right? And that Verizon says to Google, you know, you have free access to our users, like all edge providers, but if you want to get there faster, we're going to charge you $200 a month. Now, that's okay under the anti-blocking rule, right? Because if Google decides not to pay, they still have free access. They just don't get it at a faster rate. That doesn't violate anti-blocking, correct? That's what Mr. Lev told us this week.
And that's correct.
And if we make that clear in opinion, aren't you completely protected?
I think so. And again, I have to reiterate that if there were a no-blocking rule and the commission did not consider the existence or not of charges, didn't tie it to charging, and it was just a pure conduct restriction, no blocking, and by the way, we're not going to enforce this by looking into whether you're charging. You're not telling the businessman that you can't,
but you can't
charge.
For normal service, you can't charge at all. No edge provider has to pay anything unless they want faster service.
Not under these rules. They pay nothing for access, for basic service.
You're entitled to charge.
Yes.
And if somebody refuses to pay, you think you're entitled to block.
Yes, it's the ban on.
Why are you even hesitating? That's so obvious.
Because you're smarter than I am, just.
This is not a trap. I'm just trying to understand it.
In my second hypothetical, where you charge Google extra for faster service, if Google doesn't want to pay, you wouldn't block Google, right? Google just wouldn't get the faster service.
That's clear.
Yes.
So that's why the anti-blocking and the anti-discrimination provisions work differently.
They work differently, but they certainly work together. They guarantee a minimum level of access.
You and I were making a lot of progress about 8 minutes ago.
I'm sorry. What would you like me to get back to?
We seem to have lost our...
Counsel, anything that you must say?
I would like to ask a lot more questions about the findings here. And this I'm not trying to trap you. I'm asking you about these so-called findings in paragraph 27, which I referred to. The use of the word may. Many end users may have limited choice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If those were switched around to propositions that end users do not have limited choice, and that they cannot switch broadband providers, and that they do not know whether charge or service levels, in other words, instead of the use of the word may, does
right.
that change the case?
No.
Yes, it does. Or excuse me. doesn't that then go into market power, which I think you initially agreed and then took back the notion that market power would allow the FCC, under a proper interpretation of 706, to conclude, notwithstanding the barrier on common carriage, that regulation was appropriate.
Allow me to clarify. Those statutory terms, which are primarily deregulatory about the removal of barriers to investment, I think cannot bear the weight of these particular rules, particularly against the backdrop.
Even if there's a flat finding,
these were deregulatory provisions in a deregulatory 96 act, and the language just doesn't address
you're
it.
You're totally taking back the concession.
Yes. Yes, and thank you for the opportunity to clarify. Yes.
I didn't like that. I like the concession.
Well, I'm glad I did have the chance to clarify that. Because
all right, so having clarified that.
One other point, and I'll be very fast, Judge Rogers. You seem to understand that the Commission's focus on end users rather than edge providers is an empty formalism. I wanted to bring to your attention that the...
I don't think you should assume that.
Okay. Well, their own precedent that they cited in their SIR reply on this point, the access charge reform order, they pointed to paragraph 188, explains that the Commission has something called the constructive ordering doctrine, which means that you need not affirmatively request or order service. It is enough that you put yourself in the position to receive the benefits of an access service and that you, in fact, do so. That paragraph even notes that this court, in a case called Capital Network Systems, recognized the doctrine. There is no need for an affirmative request for service. So whatever you think about that argument on the merits, it's flatly contradicted by their own precedent that they brought to your attention in the SIR reply.
And I just want to be clear, I mean, I'll look at the case, but that case is interpreting Section 201B.
Yes, but it, you know, we say that this is why this is common carrier style regulation, because you can have that kind of a common carrier relationship, not just with the end user, but with third parties who also want to use your service. So an affirmative request is not required, and there's long precedent against that on the FCC side. Title III, we didn't really get a chance to talk about that, would provide no authority at all for the fixed rules. The commission did not cite 303B, which was the key provision you relied on in Selco, Judge Tatel. Mm-hmm. It is not in this order. Reliance on that is barred by Chenery. So I think
the commission responds
and says, we relied on Title III.
Right. Selco says that that is really not enough, and where you specifically discuss something, that's what is required. For all these reasons, we would ask that you vacate the order in its entirety.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement and take a brief recess.
Andrew, call a verbal update. Brief recess.